This is Audible.
What got you here won't get you there. How successful people become even more successful. Written by Marshall Goldsmith and Mark Ryder. Narrated by Jared Vanderbeck. This book is a collaborative effort that has been built upon by the contributions of many great people. My mentors and teachers, Peter Drucker and Richard Beckhard, who will never cease being my heroes. Paul Hersey, who gave me the opportunity to be an executive educator. Francis Hesselbein, my permanent role model. Bob Tannenbaum, John Ying, and Fred Case, who were great teachers and made sure that I graduated. My collaborator and agent, Mark Ryder, who has helped me find my voice and communicate in print the way I communicate in person. My publisher, Will Schwalbe, Alan Archer, Bob Miller, Zareen Jaffrey, and all of the folks at Hyperion who have supported our book. My family, Lida, Kelly, and Brian, whom I love and who love me, in spite of my annoying habits. They keep everything in perspective and make it all fun. Alliant International University, President Geoff Cox and his staff, who have had the faith required to name a college after me, the Marshall Goldsmith School of Management, and their faculty and students, working with them has been a joy. My professional partner over the past 30 years, from Keelty, Goldsmith & Company, to A4SL, and now Marshall Goldsmith Partners, who have helped me spread the word, Linkage, IMS, the Conference Board, the AMA, HR.com, Charthouse, Talent Management, and Targeted Learning, who have helped me to reach over a million leaders, Sarah MacArthur, John Wheaton, and Andrew Thorne, who provided specific contributions to this book. They know where, what, and why. My writing friends, John Byrne at Business Week, who has always encouraged me to express myself. Larissa McFarquhar at The New Yorker, who wrote a wonderful profile about my work. Gardner Morse at the Harvard Business Review. Bob Lenzer at Forbes. Ken Shelton at Leadership Excellence. And closest to home, Michael Kinsman at the San Diego Union-Tribune. All have written stories about me that were both fun and fair. Mark Vamos at Fast Company, as well as Wiley, Amicon, FT, and Davies Black, who have published my work in the past and who have given me permission to build upon that work in this book. And most importantly, my clients, who are already unbelievably successful, yet strive to get even more. They have taught me far more than I have ever taught them. Despite the help of all the people named above, I am sure these pages contain at least a few errant statements. For these, I ask your forgiveness and take full responsibility. To paraphrase another hero of mine, Buddha, please just use what works for you and let go of the rest. Section 1. The Trouble with Success, in which we learn how our precious success often prevents us from achieving more success. Chapter 1. You Are Here. You know those maps in shopping malls that say, "You are here." They exist to orient you in unfamiliar territory, to tell you where you are, where you want to go, and how to get there. A few people never need these maps. They're blessed with an internal compass that orients them automatically. They always make the correct turn and end up where they intended via the most economical route. Some people actually go through life with this unerring sense of direction. It guides them not only in shopping malls, but in their school years, careers, marriages, and friendships. When we meet people like this, we say they're grounded. They know who they are and where they're going. We feel secure around them. We feel that any surprises will only be pleasant surprises. They are our role models and heroes. We all know people like this. For some of us, it's our moms or dads, people who served as moral anchors in our stormy childhoods. For others, it's a spouse, the proverbial better half. For others, like me, it's a college professor who was the first person to puncture our pretensions. More on that later. It could be a mentor at work, a coach in high school, a hero from the history books, such as Lincoln or Churchill, a religious leader, such as Buddha, Muhammad, or Jesus. It could even be a celebrity. I know one man who solves every dilemma by asking himself, "What would Paul Newman do?" What all these role models have in common is an exquisite sense of who they are, which translates into perfect pitch about how they come across to others. A few people never seem to need any help in getting to where they want to go. They have a built-in GPS mechanism. These people do not need my help. The people I meet during the course of my working day as an executive coach are great people who may have lost their internal "you are here" map. For example, case one. Carlos is the CEO of a successful food company. He is brilliant, hardworking, and an expert in his field. He started out on the factory floor and rose through sales and marketing to the top spot. There is nothing in his business that he hasn't seen firsthand. Like many creative people, he is also hyperactive, with the metabolism and attention span of a hummingbird. He loves to buzz around his company's facilities, dropping in on employees to see what they're working on and shoot the breeze. Carlos loves people, and he loves to talk. All in all, Carlos presents a very charming package, except when his mouth runs ahead of his brain. 1 month ago, his design team presented him with their ideas for the packaging of a new line of snacks. Carlos was delighted with the designs. He only had one suggestion. "What do you think about changing the color to baby blue?" he said. "Blue says expensive and upmarket." Today the designers are back with the finished packaging. Carlos is pleased with the results, but he muses aloud, "I think it might be better in red." The design team in unison rolls their eyes. They are confused. A month ago, their CEO said he preferred blue. They busted their humps to deliver a finished product to his liking, and now he's changed his mind. They leave the meeting dispirited and less than enthralled with Carlos. Carlos is a very confident CEO, but he has a bad habit of verbalizing any and every internal monologue in his head, and he doesn't fully appreciate that this habit becomes a make-or-break issue as people ascend the chain of command. A lowly clerk expressing an opinion doesn't get people's notice at a company, but when the CEO expresses that opinion, everyone jumps to attention. The higher you go, the more your suggestions become orders. Carlos thinks he's merely tossing an idea against the wall to see if it sticks. His employees think he's giving them a direct command. Carlos thinks he's running a democracy, with everyone allowed to voice their opinion. His employees think it's a monarchy, with Carlos as king. Carlos thinks he's giving people the benefit of his years of experience. His employees see it as micromanaging and excessive meddling. Carlos has no idea how he's coming across to his employees. He is guilty of habit number two, adding too much value. Case two. Sharon is the editor of a major magazine. She is highly motivated, energetic, articulate, and loaded with charisma. For someone who has spent much of her adult life working with words and pictures, she has developed impressive people skills. She can coax delinquent writers into meeting their deadlines. She can inspire her staff to stay at their desks late into the night when she decides to tear up the next issue at the last minute. She believes she can persuade anyone if she really puts her mind to it. Her publisher often invites her on sales calls to advertisers because of her charm and her ability to sell the magazine. Sharon is particularly proud of her ability to spot and nurture young editorial talent. The proof is in the bright, energetic editorial team she has assembled. Editors at competitive magazines call them the Sharonistas because of their almost militant allegiance to Sharon. They've been working with her for years. Their loyalty is unwavering, and Sharon returns their affection with equally fierce loyalty. That loyalty may seem excessive, especially if you work for Sharon but don't qualify as a Sharonista. In today's editorial meeting, where future assignments are meted out to the staff, Sharon offered up an observation that might make a good cover story. One of the Sharonistas immediately seconded the idea, saying it was brilliant. Sharon assigned the story to her. And so the meeting proceeded, with Sharon handing out plum assignments to her staff favorites, all of whom returned the favor by fawning over Sharon and agreeing with everything she said. If you happen to be one of Sharon's favorite staffers, the love fest at the editorial meeting would be the highlight of your month. On the other hand, if you were not one of Sharon's favorite staffers or happened to disagree with her, the sycophancy level in the room would have been transparent and sickening. After a few months of this treatment, you would have been emailing your resume to other magazines. None of this was apparent to Sharon, who is otherwise extremely shrewd about people and their motives. She believed she was being an effective leader. She was developing people who shared her vision for the magazine. She was building a solid team that could operate seamlessly. Sharon thought she was encouraging the staff to grow and eventually emulate her success. The staffers outside her inner circle thought she was encouraging sucking up. Sharon is guilty of habit number 14, playing favorites. Case 3. Martin is a financial consultant for a prominent New York City firm. He manages money for high net worth individuals. The minimum starting account is $5 million. Martin is very good at what he does. He takes home a seven-figure salary. That's a lot less than most of his clients make in a year. But Martin doesn't envy or resent his clients. He lives and breathes investments. He loves providing a valued service for his well-heeled clients, many of them CEOs, some of them self-made entrepreneurs, some of them entertainment stars, and the rest of them beneficiaries or inherited wealth. Martin enjoys rubbing shoulders with his clients. He likes talking to them on the phone and giving them the benefit of his expertise over lunch or dinner, almost as much as he likes beating the market by 4 points each year. Martin is not a manager of other people. He operates as a lone wolf at his firm. His only obligation is to his clients and seeing that they're happy with the state of their portfolios from year to year. Today is one of the biggest days of Martin's life. He has been invited to manage a portion of the investment portfolio of one of America's most admired business titans. People with enormous net worth often do that, parceling out their millions to several money managers as a protective hedge. Martin has a chance to join an elite group in the Titan stable. If he's successful, there's no telling how many more clients will spring from this relationship. He's calling on the Titan in his office perched high atop Rockefeller Center. Martin knows that this will be his only chance to make a good impression on the Titan. He has 1 hour to gain his confidence and trust and the millions in his account. Martin has done this many times. He has a veteran poise and confidence when he sells to a prospect, and he has a superlative track record of market-beating returns. So it's a little surprising that he doesn't rise to the occasion in his meeting with the Titan. Immediately upon entering the Titan's office, when the Titan says, "Tell me a little about yourself," Martin starts selling his expertise. He tries to dazzle the Titan with a rundown of his more prescient trades, explaining in great detail his investment rationale and how he ended up miles ahead of the competition. He talks about some of his more prominent clients. He outlines some ideas he has for the man's portfolio and where he sees various markets heading in the near and long terms. Martin is on such a roll that he doesn't notice that the scheduled hour has gone by in a flash. That's when the Titan stands up and thanks Martin for taking the time to see him. Martin's a little surprised by the abrupt ending to the meeting. He never got a chance to ask the Titan about his goals, his attitudes to risk, and what he was looking for in a portfolio manager. But as he rewinds the meeting in his mind, Martin is satisfied that he presented a strong case for himself, hitting all the high notes in his pitch. The next day, Martin receives a handwritten note from the Titan, thanking him again, but informing him that he will be going in another direction. Martin has lost the account, and he has no idea why. Martin thought he was winning over the Titan with overwhelming evidence of his financial acumen. The Titan was thinking, "What an egotistical jackass. When's he going to ask what's on my mind? I'm never letting this fellow near my money." Martin is guilty of habit number 20, an excessive need to be me. It's not that these people don't know who they are, or where they're going, or what they want to achieve, nor is it that they don't have an adequate sense of self-worth. In fact, they tend to be very successful, and their self-esteem can often be excessive. What's wrong is that they have no idea how their behavior is coming across to the people who matter, their bosses, colleagues, subordinates, customers, and clients. And that's not just true at work. The same goes for their home life. They think they have all the answers, but others see it as arrogance. They think they're contributing to a situation with helpful comments, but others see it as butting in. They think they're delegating effectively, but others see it as shirking responsibilities. They think they're holding their tongue, but others see it as unresponsiveness. They think they're letting people think for themselves, but others see it as ignoring them. Over time, these minor workplace foibles begin to chip away at the goodwill we've all accumulated in life and that other people normally extend to colleagues and friends. That's when the minor irritation blows up into a major crisis. Why does this happen? More often than not, it's because people's inner compass of correct behavior has gone out of whack and they become clueless about their position among their coworkers. In an article that ran in The New Yorker, film director Harold Ramis commented on the reasons behind the fading career of Chevy Chase, one of the stars of Ramis's Caddyshack. Ramis said, Do you know the concept of proprioception, of how you know where you are and where you're oriented? Chevy lost his sense of proprioception, lost touch with what he was projecting to people. It's strange because you couldn't write Chevy as a character in a novel because his whole attitude is just superiority. I'm Chevy Chase, and you're not. Well, I work as an executive coach with successful people who have a slightly dented sense of proprioception. They look at the map of their life and career. It tells them, you are here. But they don't accept it. They may resist the truth. They may think, like Chevy Chase's famous line, I'm successful and you're not, which is their license to think, why change if it's working? I wish I had the power to snap my fingers and make these people immediately see the need to change. I wish I could beam them into Groundhog Day, another Ramis film, and one of my all-time favorites because it's about how people can change for the better. And make them relive the same day, perhaps their worst day, over and over again until they mend their ways. I wish I had the temperament to shake them by the shoulders and make them face reality. I wish I could turn their flaws into life-threatening diseases because it would compel them to change on pain of death. But I can't, and I don't. Instead, I show these people what their colleagues at work really think of them. It's called feedback. It's the only tool I need to show people, you are here. And in this book, I will show you how to wield that weapon on yourself and others. It doesn't take much to get people reoriented, out of the maze, and back on the right path. The problems we'll be looking at in this book are not life-threatening diseases, although ignored for too long, they can destroy a career. They're not deep-seated neuroses that require years of therapy or tons of medication to ease. More often than not, they are simple behavioral tics, bad habits that we repeat dozens of times a day in the workplace, which can be cured by A, pointing them out, B, showing the havoc they cause among the people surrounding us, and C, demonstrating that with a slight behavioral tweak, we can achieve a much more appealing effect. It's a little like a stage actor who keeps stepping on a pivotal line in a comedy, thus ruining any chance of securing a big laugh from the audience. It's the director's job to notice this and alter the actor's delivery so that the line elicits the essential roar of laughter from the audience. No laugh, no play. If the actor can't adjust his delivery successfully, the producer will find someone who can. Well, think of me as a caring director who helps you deliver your lines for maximum effect. A journalist once told me that the most important thing he's learned in his career is this. Put a comma in the wrong place, and the whole sentence is screwed up. You may have an admirable skill set for a journalist. You can investigate the facts like the CSI team. You can interview people as if you've known them all your life. You can empathize with victims and excoriate the bad guys. You can spin words together beautifully on deadline and create rich, meaningful metaphors that leave readers gasping with admiration. And yet, if you put a comma in the wrong place, that tiny sin of commission can wipe out the rest of your contributions. Think of me as a friendly grammarian who can shield you from bad punctuation. A chef at my favorite restaurants in San Diego told me that his signature dish succeeds or fails on one secret ingredient, which, like Coca-Cola's heavily guarded recipe, he refuses to reveal. Leave it out and the patrons' plates come back to the kitchen only half eaten. Sprinkle it in the proper amount and the plates come back clean. Think of me as the honest diner who sends back the meal untouched to let you know that something is missing. Actors stepping on a line, writers misusing commas, chefs leaving out a key ingredient. That's what we're talking about here in the workplace. People who do one annoying thing repeatedly on the job and don't realize that this small flaw may sabotage their otherwise golden career. And worse, they do not realize that, A, it's happening, and B, they can fix it. This book is your map. A map that can turn the maze of wrong turns in the workplace into a straight line to the top. In the arc of what can be a long, successful career, you will always be in transit from here to there. Here can be a great place. If you're successful, here is exactly the kind of place you want to be. Here is a place where you can be the CEO of a thriving company. Here is a place where you can be the editor of one of America's top magazines. Here is a place where you can be an in-demand financial manager. But here is also a place where you can be a success in spite of some gaps in your behavior or personal makeup. That's why you want to go there. There can be a better place. There is a place where you can be a CEO who is viewed as a great leader because he doesn't get in the way of his people. There is a place where you can be a great editor who builds a strong team and treats all of her direct reports with respect. There is a place where you can be a financial pro who listens well and delivers the message that he cares more about his clients' goals than his own needs. You don't have to be a CEO or leading editor or financial wizard to benefit from this book. Look at your own personal map. Trace the distance between your vision of here and there. You are here. You can get there. But you have to understand that what got you here won't get you there. Let the journey begin. Chapter 2. Enough about you. Let's talk about me. Who am I to tell you how to change? My career as an executive coach began with a phone call from the CEO of a Fortune 100 company. I had just given a leadership clinic to the CEO's human resources department. That's what I was doing back then in the late 1980s, advising HR departments about identifying future leaders in their companies and creating programs to form them into better leaders. The CEO attended the session and must have heard something that struck a nerve. That's why he was using his very valuable time to call me. Something was on his mind. Marshall, I've got this guy running a big division who delivers his numbers and more every quarter, said the CEO. He's a young, smart, dedicated, ethical, motivated, hardworking, entrepreneurial, creative, charismatic, arrogant, stubborn, know-it-all jerk. Trouble is, we're a company built on team values, and no one thinks he's a team player. I'm giving him a year to change, or he's out. But you know something? It would be worth a fortune to us if we could turn this guy around. My ears perked up at the word fortune. Up until then, I had been teaching large groups of leaders how to change behavior, their own, and that of their peers in direct reports. I had never worked one-on-one with an executive before, and certainly not with someone who was one click away from the CEO's chair at a multi-billion dollar company. I didn't know this fellow, but from the CEO's terse description, I had a good picture in my mind. He was a success junkie, the kind of guy who had triumphed at each successive rung of the achievement ladder. He liked to win, whether it was at work, at touch football, in a poker game, or in an argument with a stranger. He could charm a customer, turn everyone around to his position in a meeting, and get his bosses to want to help him advance through the organization. He had high potential stamped on his forehead since the day he entered the company. He was also financially independent, rich enough that he didn't have to work. He wanted to. All of these ingredients, the talent, charm, and brains, the unbroken track record of success, the screw-you money in the bank that let him think he could flip off the world, made this fellow a potent mix of stubbornness and pride and defensiveness. How could I help someone like this change? Someone whose entire life, from his paycheck to his title to the hundreds of direct reports who did his daily bidding, was an affirmation that he was doing everything right. More important, even if I had an inkling how to do it, why would I want to beat my head against this particular wall? I was intrigued by the challenge and the word fortune. I had coached plenty of mid-level managers in groups before. These were people on the verge of success, but not quite there yet. Could my methods work on a more elite flight of executive material? Could I take someone who is demonstrably successful and make him or her more successful? It would be an interesting test. I told the CEO, I might be able to help. The CEO sighed. I doubt it. Tell you what, I said. I'll work with him for a year. If he gets better, pay me. If not, it's all free. The next day, I caught a return trip to New York City to meet the CEO and his division chief. That was 20 years ago. Since then, I've personally worked with more than 100 executives of similar status, brainpower, wealth, and achievement, who have at least one incredible career-damaging interpersonal challenge. That's what I do now. I have a PhD in organizational behavior from UCLA and 29 years of experience measuring and analyzing behavior in organizations. Now I apply it one-on-one with very successful people who want to become more successful. My job is not to make them smarter or richer. My job is to help them. To identify a personal habit that's annoying their coworkers and to help them eliminate it so that they retain their value to the organization. My job is to make them see that the skills and habits that have taken them this far might not be the right skills and habits to take them further. What got them here won't get them there. But I don't work only with the super successful. That's a critical part of my business, but I spend most of my time teaching people who reside somewhere below the absolute top rungs of the organizational ladder. They need help too. There's a correlation between an individual's standing in the corporation pyramid and what his coworkers think of his interpersonal skills. Middle managers are no less immune than CEOs to being perceived as arrogant, inattentive, rude, and unfoundedly omniscient. My target audience is the huge cohort of people who are successful in their own minds, but want to be even more successful. I train people to behave effectively in the workplace by enrolling them in a simple but brutal regimen. First, I solicit 360-degree feedback from their colleagues, as many as I can talk to up, down, and sideways in the chain of command, often including family members, for a comprehensive assessment of their strengths and weaknesses. Then I confront them with what everyone really thinks about them. Assuming that they accept this information, agree that they have the room to improve, and commit to changing that behavior, then I show them how to do it. I help them apologize to everyone affected by their flawed behavior, because it's the only way to erase the negative baggage associated with their prior actions, and ask the same people for help in getting better. I help them advertise their efforts to get better, because you have to tell people that you're trying to change. They won't notice it on their own. Then I help them follow up religiously every month or so with their colleagues, because it's the only honest way to find out how you're doing, and it also reminds people that you're still trying. As an integral part of this follow-up process, I teach people to listen without prejudice to what their colleagues, family members, and friends are saying. That is, listen without interrupting or arguing. I also show them that the only proper response to whatever they hear is gratitude. That is, I teach them how to say thank you without ruining the gesture or embellishing it. I am a huge apostle for thanking. Finally, I teach them the miracle of feed forward, which is my special sauce methodology for eliciting advice from people on what they can do to get better in the future. It's often humbling for these overachievers, but after 12 to 18 months, they get better, not only in their own minds, but more important, in the opinions of their coworkers. As I say, it's a simple process. But how I got here could fill a book. This book. And I hasten to add that it is a book that can help a lot more people than just the super successful among us. That would be like writing a golf instructional just for PGA Tour players. An interesting exercise, perhaps, but useful only to 0.000001% of the golf-playing universe. It's not worth the effort. I don't use a golf analogy lightly. I live next to a golf course where I can observe golfers, and I am convinced that in the context of helping successful people get better, nothing is more relevant than golf instruction. Golfers suffer all the symptoms of successful people, perhaps even more acutely. For one thing, they're delusional about their success. They claim, and even believe, they're doing better than they really are. If they break 90 one time out of 100 rounds, that exceptional round will quickly become their usual game. Golfers are also delusional about how they achieve success. That's why they award themselves second shots, called mulligans, when the first one's gone the wrong direction, move the ball from an awkward lie, conveniently neglect to count the occasional errant stroke, and otherwise fiddle with the rules and scorecard, all in an effort to buff up their handicaps and take credit for a better game than they actually possess. Golfers, like business people, also tend to be delusional about their weaknesses, which they deny. This explains why they spend much of their time practicing what they're already good at, and little time on the areas of their game that need work. How are these traits any different than bosses who claim more credit for a success than they're entitled to, who stretch the truth to gain an advantage, and who think they're strong in areas where others know they are weak? Golfers, like the leaders I coach, have one singularly noble quality. No matter how good they are, whether they sport a 30 handicap or play to scratch, they all want to get better. That's why they're always practicing, scheduling lessons, trying out new equipment, fiddling with their swing, and poring over instructional advice in magazines and books. That's the spirit underlying this book. It's aimed at anyone who wants to get better at work, at home, or any other venue. If I can help you consider the possibility that despite your demonstrable success and laudable self-esteem, you might not be as good as you think you are. That all of us have corners in our behavioral makeup that are messy, and that these messy corners can be pinpointed and tidied up. Then I can leave the world, and your world, a slightly better place than I found it. Okay, enough about me. Let's get back to you. Chapter 3. The Success Delusion, or Why We Resist Change. Unum, the insurance company, ran an ad some years ago showing a powerful grizzly bear in the middle of a roaring stream, with his neck extended to the limit, jaws open wide, teeth flaring. The bear was about to clamp on to an unsuspecting airborne salmon jumping upstream. The headline read, "You probably feel like the bear. We'd like to suggest you're the salmon." The ad was designed to sell disability insurance, but it struck me as a powerful statement about how all of us in the workplace delude ourselves about our achievements, our status, and our contributions. We overestimate our contribution to a project. We take credit, partial or complete, for successes that truly belong to others. We have an elevated opinion of our professional skills and our standing among our peers. We conveniently ignore the costly failures and time-consuming deadlines we have created. We exaggerate our project's impact on net profits because we discount the real and hidden costs built into them. The costs are someone else's problem. The success is ours. All of these delusions are a direct result of success, not failure. That's because we get positive reinforcement from our past successes and, in a mental leap that's easy to justify, we think that our past success is predictive of great things in our future. This is not necessarily a bad thing. This wacky delusional belief in our godlike omniscience instills us with confidence, however unearned it may be. It erases doubt. It blinds us to the risks and challenges in our work. If we had a complete grip on reality, seeing every situation for exactly what it is, we wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. After all, the most realistic people in our society are the chronically depressed. But our delusions become a serious liability when we need to change. We sit there with the same godlike feelings, and when someone tries to make us change our ways, we regard them with unadulterated bafflement. It's an interesting three-part response. First, we think the other party is confused. They're misinformed and don't know what they're talking about. They have us mixed up with someone who truly does need to change, but we are not that person. Second, as it dawns on us that maybe the other party is not confused, maybe their information about our perceived shortcomings is accurate, we go into denial mode. The criticism does not apply to us, or else we wouldn't be so successful. Finally, when all else fails, we attack the other party. We discredit the messenger. Why is a smart guy like me, we think, listening to a loser like you? Those are just the initial surface responses, the denial mechanisms. Couple them with very positive interpretations that successful people assign to A, their past performance, B, their ability to influence their success rather than just being lucky, C, their optimistic belief that their success will continue in the future, and D, their sense of control over their own destiny, as opposed to being controlled by external forces, and you have a volatile cocktail of resistance to change. Four key beliefs help us become successful. Each can make it tough for us to change, and that's the paradox of success. These beliefs that carried us here may be holding us back in the quest to go there. Let's look more closely at each of these beliefs that can prevent us from changing our proven ways. Belief 1. I have succeeded. Successful people believe in their skills and talent. Successful people have one idea coursing silently through their veins and brains all day. It's a mantra that goes like this. I have succeeded. I have succeeded. I have succeeded. It's their way of telling themselves that they have the skills and talent to win and keep winning. Whether or not they actually voice it inside their heads, this is what successful people are telling themselves. You may not believe it applies to you. You think that this is egos run amok, but look at yourself. How do you have the confidence to wake up in the morning and charge into work, filled with optimism and desire and the eagerness to compete. It's not because you're reminding yourself of all the screw-ups you created and failures you've endured in recent days. On the contrary, it's because you edit out the failures and choose instead to run the highlight reel of your successes. If you're like most people I know, you're constantly focusing on the positive, calling up images of performances where you were the star, where you dazzled everyone and came out on top. It might be those 5 minutes in a meeting where you had the floor and nailed the argument you wanted to make. Who wouldn't run that highlight in their head as if it were the SportsCenter play of the day? It might be your skillfully crafted memo that the boss praised and routed to everyone in the company. Who wouldn't want to reread that memo in a spare moment? Whatever the evidence, if it has a happy ending that makes us look good, we'll replay it for ourselves and retell it to anyone who will listen. You'll see this confident mindset in your successful friends simply by the stories you hear them repeat. Are they recounting their blunders, or are they tales of triumphs? If they're successful friends, it's the latter. When it comes to the thoughts we hold inside our heads, we are not self-deprecating. We are self-aggrandizing, and that's a good thing. Without it, we might not get up in the morning. I once got into a conversation about this with a Major League Baseball player. Every hitter has certain pitches whom he historically hits better than others. He told me, "When I face a pitcher whom I've hit well in the past, I always go up to the plate thinking, I own this guy. That gives me confidence." That's not surprising. To successful people, past is always prologue, and the past is always rose-colored. But he took that thinking one step further. "What about pitchers whom you don't hit well?" I asked. "How do you deal with a pitcher who owns you?" "Same thing," he said. "I go up to the plate thinking I can hit this guy. I've done it before against pitchers a lot better than he is." In other words, not only did he lean on his past success to maintain a successful attitude, but he relied on it even when his past performance was not so rosy, i.e., when the evidence contradicted his self-confidence. Successful people never drink from a glass that's half empty. They do the same even when it's a team effort. No matter how much they respect their teammates, when a team achieves great results, they tend to believe that their contribution was more significant than facts suggest. I once polled 3 business partners to estimate the percentage that each of them contributed to their partnership's profits. Since I knew the senior partner in this particular enterprise, I knew the true numbers. And yet, the 3 partners' combined estimate came to over 150%. Each man thought he was contributing more than half of the firm's profits. This is not merely true of the people I work with. It's true in any workplace. If you ask your colleagues to estimate their percentage contribution to your enterprise, the total will always exceed 100%. There's nothing wrong with this. You want to surround yourself with confident people. If your total ever comes to less than 100%, I suggest you find new colleagues. This "I succeeded" belief, positive as it is most times, only becomes an obstacle when behavioral change is needed. Successful people constantly compare themselves favorably to their peers. If you ask successful professionals to rate themselves against their peers, as I have done with more than 50,000 people in my training programs, 80 to 85% of them will rate themselves in the top 20% of their peer group, and 70% will rate themselves in the top 10%. This number goes even higher among professionals with higher perceived social status, such as physicians, pilots, and investment bankers, 90% of whom place themselves in the top percent. Doctors may be the most delusional. I once told a group of MDs that my extensive research proved that exactly half of all MDs graduated in the bottom half of their medical class. 2 doctors in the room insisted this was impossible. Imagine trying to tell people like this that they're doing something wrong and need to change. Belief 2. I can succeed. This is another way of saying, I am confident that I can succeed. Successful people believe that they have the capability within themselves to make desirable things happen. It's not quite like a carnival magic act where the mentalist moves objects on a table with his mind or bends steel, but it's close. Successful people literally believe that through sheer force of personality or talent or brain power, they can steer a situation in their direction. It's the reason why some people raise their hand and say, Put me in, coach. When the boss asks for volunteers to solve a problem, and others cower in a corner, praying they won't be noticed. This is the classic definition of self-efficacy, and it may be the most central belief driving individual success. People who believe they can succeed see opportunities where others see threats. They're not afraid of uncertainty or ambiguity. They embrace it. They want to take greater risks and achieve greater returns. Given the choice, they will always bet on themselves. Successful people tend to have a high internal locus of control. In other words, they do not feel like victims of fate. They see success for themselves and others as largely a function of people's motivation and ability, not luck, random chance, or external factors. They carry this belief even when luck does play a critical role. Several years ago, six of my partners wanted to get involved in a very large deal. Since I was a senior partner, they needed my approval. I was against it, telling them it was idiotic. I finally agreed, but kicking and screaming. 7 years later, the return on my idiotic investment was the biggest lump sum check I'd ever received. Seven digits to the left of the decimal point. There's no other way to describe it except dumb luck. But some of my more successful friends didn't see it this way. They insisted that my good fortune had little to do with luck and was really a payoff for years of hard work. This is the classic response from successful people. We tend to believe that success is earned through an individual's motivation and ability, even when it's not. Of course, this belief makes about as much sense as inheriting money and thinking you're a self-made man. If you're born on third base, you shouldn't think you hit a triple. Successful people, however, believe there is always a link between what they have done and how far they have come, even when no link exists. It's delusional, but it's also empowering. This belief is certainly better than the alternative. Take the example of people who buy state lottery tickets. It is a statistical fact that state-run lotteries are regressive taxes on people who are not the highest income earners. Serious lottery players tend to believe that any success is a function of luck, external factors, or random chance. This is the opposite belief of most successful people, and why you rarely see millionaires scratching tickets. These serious scratchers see the lottery as a manifestation of the randomness of success. They feel that they might get lucky and win millions of dollars if they buy enough lottery tickets. Studies show that people with these beliefs tend not to be high achievers or high wage earners. To make matters worse, many people who win high payouts in the lottery often do a poor job investing their winnings. The same belief that led them to buy hundreds of lottery tickets are reinforced when they win the lottery. That is, they make irrational investment decisions, hoping again that luck, rather than their skill and intelligence, will make them richer. That's why they plunge into questionable schemes. They don't have the base belief that they can succeed on their own, so they rely on luck. Successful people trade in this lottery mentality for an unshakable belief in themselves, and that presents another obstacle for helping them change their behavior. One of the greatest mistakes of successful people is the assumption, I am successful, I behave this way. Therefore, I must be successful because I behave this way. The challenge is to make them see that sometimes they are successful in spite of this behavior. Belief 3. I will succeed. This is another way of saying, I have the motivation to succeed. If I have succeeded refers to the past, and I can succeed to the present, then I will succeed refers to the future. Successful people have an unflappable optimism. They not only believe that they can manufacture success, they believe it's practically their due. As a result, successful people tend to pursue opportunities with an enthusiasm that others may find mystifying. If they set a goal and publicly announce it, they tend to do whatever it takes to achieve the goal. That's a good thing, but it can easily mutate into excessive optimism. It explains why successful people tend to be extremely busy and face the danger of overcommitment. It can be difficult for an ambitious person with an "I will succeed" attitude to say no to desirable opportunities. The huge majority of executives that I work with feel as busy or busier today than they have ever felt in their lives. I have never heard one of my clients say, "I don't have enough on my plate." And this busyness is not because they have so many problems to deal with. When I surveyed executives about why they felt overcommitted, none of them said they were trying to save a sinking ship. They were overcommitted because they were drowning in a sea of opportunity. Perhaps this has happened to you. You do something wonderful at work. Suddenly, lots of people want to rub up against you and associate themselves with your success. They think, quite logically, that since you pulled off a miracle once, you can pull it off again for them. So, opportunities are thrust at you at a pace that you have never seen before. You are not experienced or disciplined enough to say no to some of them. If you're not careful, you'll be overwhelmed in due course, and that which made you rise will bring about your fall. In my volunteer work, my favorite European client was the executive director of one of the world's leading human services organizations. His purpose was to help the world's most vulnerable people. Unfortunately, for all of us, his business was booming. When people came to him for help, he didn't have the heart or inclination to say no. Everything was driven by this belief that we will succeed. As a result, he promised even more than the most dedicated staffers could deliver. The danger with this, of course, is that unchecked, this "we will succeed" attitude leads to staff burnout, high turnover, and a weaker team than the one you started with. His biggest challenge as a leader was avoiding overcommitment. This "I will succeed" belief can sabotage our chances for success when it's time for us to change behavior. I make no apology for the fact that I'm obsessed with following up with my clients to see if they actually get better by using my methods. Almost every participant who attends my leadership development programs intends to apply what he or she has learned back on the job. Most do, and get better. And, as our research to be discussed later shows, many do absolutely nothing. They may as well have spent the time watching sitcoms instead of attending my training program. When the do-nothings are asked, "Why didn't you implement the behavioral change that you said you would?" By far the most common response is, "I meant to, but I just didn't have the time to get to it." In other words, they were overcommitted. It's not that they didn't want to change or didn't agree with the value of changing. They just ran out of hours in the day. They thought that they would get to it later, and later never arrived. Overcommitment can be as serious an obstacle to change as believing that you don't need fixing or that your flaws are part of the reason you're successful. Belief 4. I choose to succeed. Successful people believe that they are doing what they chose to do. Because they choose to do it, they have a high need for self-determination. The more successful a person is, the more likely this is to be true. When we do what we choose to do, we are committed. When we do what we have to do, we are compliant. You see the difference in any job, even where money is not related to performance. Even a skeptical, wisecracking jokester like me could see that some teachers had a calling for the profession, and some teachers did it to make a living. And the best teachers were the former. They were committed to us rather than being controlled by external forces, such as a paycheck. Successful people have a unique distaste for feeling controlled or manipulated. I see this in my work every day. Even when I've gotten the greatest advanced buildup as someone who can help people change for the better, in other words, I'm effective at helping, I still meet resistance. I have now made peace with the fact that I cannot make people change. I can only help them get better at what they choose to change. The basketball coach Rick Pitino wrote a book called Success is a Choice. I agree. I choose to succeed correlates perfectly with achievement in virtually any field. People don't stumble on success, they choose it. Unfortunately, getting people who think "I have chosen to succeed" to say "and I choose to change" is not an easy transition. It means turning that muscular movement on its head. Easy to say, hard to do. The more we believe that our behavior is a result of our own choices and commitments, the less likely we want to change our behavior. There's a reason for this, and it's one of the best research principles in psychology. It's called cognitive dissonance. It refers to the disconnect between what we believe in our minds and what we experience or see in reality. The underlying theory is simple. The more we are committed to believing that something is true, the less likely we are to believe that its opposite is true, even in the face of clear evidence that shows we are wrong. For example, if you believe your colleague Bill is a jerk, you will filter Bill's actions through that belief. No matter what Bill does, you'll see it through a prism that confirms he is a jerk. Even the times when he's not a jerk, you'll interpret it as an exception to the rule that Bill's a jerk. It may take years of saintly behavior for Bill to overcome your perception. That's cognitive dissonance applied to others. It can be a disruptive and unfair force in the workplace. Yet cognitive dissonance actually works in favor of successful people when they apply it to themselves. The more we are committed to believing that something is true, the less likely we are to believe that its opposite is true, even in the face of evidence that shows we may have chosen the wrong path. It's the reason successful people don't buckle and waver when times get tough. Their commitment to their goals and beliefs allows them to view reality through rose-tinted glasses. That's a good thing in many situations. Their personal commitment encourages people to stay the course and to not give up when the going gets tough. Of course, this same steadfastness can work against successful people when they should change course. How our successes make us superstitious. These four success beliefs, that we have the skills, the confidence, the motivation, and the free choice to succeed, make us superstitious. Who, me? You say? No way, I don't believe in that stuff. I'm successful because I earned it. That may be true for childish superstitions, such as bad luck ensuing from walking under a ladder, or breaking a mirror, or letting a black cat cross our path. Most of us scorn superstitions as silly beliefs of the primitive and uneducated. Deep down inside, we assure ourselves that we're above these silly notions. Not so fast. To a degree, we're all superstitious. In many cases, the higher we climb the organizational totem pole, the more superstitious we become. Psychologically speaking, superstitious behavior comes from the mistaken belief that a specific activity that is followed by positive reinforcement is actually the cause of that positive reinforcement. The activity may be functional or not, that is, it may affect someone or something else, or it may be self-contained and pointless. But if something good happens after we do it, then we make a connection and seek to repeat the activity. Psychologist B.F. Skinner was the first to highlight this inanity by showing how hungry pigeons would repeat their twitches because doing so was randomly followed by small pellets of grain. After twitching in a certain way and then immediately getting fed, the pigeons learned to repeat the twitches. They mistakenly believed that twitching led to food. Twitch, they hoped, and you get fed. Twitch again, and you eat more. Sounds silly, doesn't it? We would never behave this way. We assure ourselves that we are more highly evolved than Skinner's pigeons. But from my experience, hungry business people repeat certain behavior all the time, day in and day out, when they believe large pellets of money and recognition will come their way because of it. Superstition is merely the confusion of correlation and causality. Any human, like any animal, tends to repeat behavior that is followed by positive reinforcement. The more we achieve, the more reinforcement we get. One of the greatest mistakes of successful people is the assumption, I behave this way and I achieve results. Therefore, I must be achieving results because I behave this way. This belief is sometimes true, but not across the board. That's where superstition kicks in. It creates the core fallacy necessitating this book. The reason that what got us here won't get us there. I'm talking about the difference between success that happens because of our behavior and the success that comes in spite of our behavior. Almost everyone I meet is successful because of doing a lot of things right. And almost everyone I meet is successful in spite of some behavior that defies common sense. One of my greatest challenges is helping leaders see the difference, see that they are confusing because of and in spite of behaviors, and avoid this superstition trap. This was my biggest hurdle when I worked with an executive, I'll call Harry. He was a brilliant, dedicated executive who consistently made his numbers. He wasn't just smart. Harry saw things no one else at the company could. Everybody high and low conceded this. His creative ideas led to groundbreaking new processes and procedures, for which everyone credited him profusely. There was no doubt that Harry had been instrumental in turning around his organization. Plus, Harry had other positives going for him. He sincerely cared about the company, employees, and shareholders. He had a great wife, two kids enrolled at top colleges, a beautiful home in a great neighborhood. The works. Life was very good for Harry. The flaw in this perfect picture, and there's always a flaw when superstition comes into play, was that Harry was a poor listener. Even though his direct reports and co-workers respected him, they felt that he didn't listen to them. Even when you factor in that they were somewhat intimidated by his quick mind and creativity, and thus more willing to accept that Harry didn't have to listen to them all the time, Harry was still a world-class aggressive non-listener. Not just a distracted genius who sometimes didn't pay attention. His colleagues consistently felt that if Harry had made up his mind on a subject, it was useless to express another opinion. This was confirmed up and down the company by feedback I conducted. And it was confirmed at home too, where his wife and kids felt that Harry often did not hear a word they said. If Harry's dog could speak, I suggest he would have barked out the same conclusion. I suggested to Harry that he was probably successful because of his talent, hard work, and some good luck. I also said he was probably successful in spite of being an appalling listener. Harry acknowledged that other people thought he should become a better listener, but he wasn't sure that he should change. He had convinced himself that his poor listening was actually a great source of his success. Like many high achievers, he wanted to defend his superstitious beliefs. He pointed out that some people present awful ideas and that he hated cluttering his fertile brain with bad ideas. Bad ideas were like brain pollution. He needed to filter them out, and he wouldn't pretend to hear out bad ideas simply because it made other people feel better. "I don't suffer fools gladly," he said, with a little more pride than patience. This was defensive reaction number one. It always happens with people caught in the superstition trap. They cling to the notion that their success is causally linked to specific behavior, good or bad, responsible or risky, legitimate or inappropriate. They refuse to accept that not all good things flow to them because of the less than good things they do. Sometimes there's no causal connection at all. It was my job to make Harry see his flawed logic. When I asked him if he really believed that his coworkers and family members were fools, he shamefacedly conceded that his comment may have been over the top. These were people he respected, people he needed to get things done, people on whose back his entire success rested. Upon further reflection, he said, "Perhaps sometimes I am the fool." This was a big step for Harry, both conceding the legitimacy of other people's feelings and recognizing that perhaps sometimes he was acting like a fool. But then, Harry went into defensive reaction number two, fear of overcorrection. He was concerned that he might start listening too much and that doing so would diminish his creative impulses. He would become too unwilling to share his opinions and eventually dry up creatively. I pointed out that the danger that a 55-year-old man who had been a bad listener for his entire life would overreact and suddenly become excessively interested in other people's opinions was extremely remote. I assured him that he could remove his concern from his things to worry about list. We were fixing one bad behavior, not manufacturing a religious conversion. Ultimately, Harry decided it was more productive to hear people out than waste time justifying his own dysfunctional behavior. Harry's case isn't an isolated event. Virtually all of us are superstitious, attaching too much value to bad behavior that we confusedly associate with our success. I've worked with people who insist their cruel moments to colleagues are absolutely necessary because their pithy, memorable zingers are where their great ideas begin. I ask them if they've ever met a person as creative as they are. It gets them thinking. I've worked with salespeople who think their pushy, belligerent sales tactics with customers are the reason they close more deals than their peers. If that were true, I point out, how do your nicer colleagues sell anything at all? Could it be that you're selling a great product or making more sales calls? I've worked with executives who insist that their remoteness, their inscrutable silences,